Welcome to the Cognitive Rampage podcast. I'm your host, Adam Lowry. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. I try to keep my monologues now to an intro short because the people on the show is who you really want to listen to anyway. So I won't hold you up too long, but I will tell you in the short time that I've got to talk to him briefly, but even just sharing emails, there is a tone about Brad that is inviting, that is, I don't know, empathetic for the cause of which he is chasing, and something about that, and that's kind of what MAPS does to all the ways. So for me, people that are passionate about what they do, that's who comes on the podcast, and Brad is very much that. And Brad, welcome to the show, man. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much, Adam. Been looking forward to it.
Oh, I am, man. I'm ready to sit still and learn, man. You know, the hardest part for me is trying to be quiet enough to where we can be educated.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. That is so true. How can we learn if we're talking all the time, right?
Yeah. I can't respond to that quickly because then I'm talking. So, I mean, Brad, you've been around a long time. You've been on a ton of podcasts. People know what you do that know of you, you know, but you know, as people know, I try not to introduce people with the long intro of qualifying. Because for me, what we do sometimes is just a part of who we are and how we live. So I like to ask actually directly from you, you know, what is it that you would say you really do?
I really appreciate that. You know, we got to let things speak for themselves. Yeah, so I'm currently working as the communications and marketing director for a nonprofit group called the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, otherwise known as MAPS, M-A-P-S. And I've been with MAPS for going on 7 to 8 years now, which from what I've seen in this day and age is a pretty long time for somebody my age to actually have a single job. So it's just kind of starting to dawn on me. It's like, yeah, actually, that's kind of a long time. I started as an intern. MAPS is a nonprofit research and educational organization that does clinical research into the benefits and the risks of psychedelics and marijuana, and then also has this really extensive public education presence as well. So in addition to doing research into, you know, what's really going on with psychedelics and cannabis, we're also working to reverse all the stigma that has been surrounding those drugs for so many decades, a century almost, really, with marijuana. So public education, reducing stigma, communicating honestly about what these drugs are, what the science says, what the research says. That's the other half of what we do. And my work is mostly in that other half. So I have the huge pleasure of being able to wake up every morning and market psychedelic research. So to sort of help people become more aware of what psychedelics are and to bring as much attention to them as possible. Whereas I think historically the tradition has been to let's like sweep them under the rug. Let's not talk about it because they're risky. Rather, my job is to, you know, make them, you know, to sort of transform them, to sort of transform the image of psychedelics from stigmatized to really legitimate scientific and medical tools and tools for consciousness and tools for spirituality.
You know, some people off rip, you know, would hear that and go, oh, you know, what a great job. But when they don't understand the forces that be to which you are really marketing to, and, you know, Dr. Carl Hart last week, you and I exchanged some emails about him, and he had some, you know, some beliefs toward that. So that, you know, it may sound good from the outside, but the war that which is really taking place through that education, through that marketing, and I use war specifically, you know, bring people into what that's really like, and rather than what it may sound like to somebody, the difficulties of doing that.
Yeah. there are so many preconceptions that people have about psychedelics, you know, all over the world. People think about psychedelics as dangerous drugs. You know, they're Schedule I drugs or illegal drugs, therefore they're dangerous drugs. You know, a lot of young people know differently, and a lot of people who have experimented recreationally with those drugs know differently and don't trust the propaganda that they've heard. But for a lot of people, you know, especially for major institutions, for governments, for media, it's still very difficult. For policymakers, we still haven't had a president or a presidential candidate make a statement about psychedelics. Mm-hmm. In the last however many decades, but certainly not since the war on drugs began. in the 1970s, really in earnest. So there's all these preconceptions that people have built in, and it seems like on a day-to-day basis, really what I'm doing is trying to identify what those preconceptions are, those fears that people have, often irrational fears that they've just learned over time and internalized, and try to find a way past that and try to find a way to engage people in a conversation about psychedelics and about cannabis and about not just how dangerous they are, but also about how they could be potentially beneficial, how we can look at them as tools rather than consistently demonizing them. So trying to change the conversations from one of fear into one of openness. That's, you know, for all the media that we do, for all the social media, for all the, you know, email newsletters and bulletins and things that we put out there, you know, really what it comes down to is identifying those fears. And I think just engaging people in a rational conversation.
Well, good luck with the internet. I can imagine the war that becomes in trying to engage in a rational conversation with somebody that is still concrete or, you know, still asleep, if you will, to the realizations of those influences of those treatments, really. But before I go, you know, deep into that, part of what I like to try to do too, man, is learn about kind of the influences, you know, the epigenetic influences, the exterior influences along your life that led you this way, not necessarily what led you to MAPS, but what made Brad Burge, you know, take me back to those game changers, those stories of whether it's childhood, teenager, wherever it is, you know, that just were game changers in your life that helped shape what you do today.
Well, thanks. You know, Adam, I just got back from the long Labor Day weekend and got out to the Lost Coast, which is a spectacular 25-30 mile stretch of beach along the Northern California coast, and just really kind of remembered how important nature is, and how important it is to get out and get moving and get away from screens and to get away from all these media that we have. So I would say that's kind of one aspect of where I come from and what excites me and what is getting outside and getting embodied. In my experience in college, when I first experienced LSD, I found it from a friend and it was circulating because you're in college, and decided to try it. And I took a long walk. I walked about 100 times around the lake at Stanford, where I was an undergraduate student, and just spent the entire time outside and really connected with that. So I think one thing that psychedelics used in the right way, in an educated way, can do for us is to reconnect us with our bodies and to remind us to move around and to be healthy. You know, and then other, you know, the other really strong influence that led me to MAPS and to be really advocating for a change to how we use psychiatric medicines and how psychiatric treatment happens is that I had used mood stabilizers. I've been given mood stabilizers by psychiatrists since I was 11 years old until I was about 20, until the very year that I first experimented with LSD and I first had an LSD experience on my own. But for all of those years, I had used mood stabilizers, and I had found that it had really dulled my experience. It had muted colors. I hadn't appreciated colors until after I got off of them. I'm talking about lithium in particular, and antidepressants, and these things. And
asking, man, and going. I mean, an 11-year-old to be dealing with SSRIs already. I mean, can you walk me through that, man? I mean,
yeah, there's an internal an internalization that happens. You know, when you're a young kid, you know, everything around you, you know, you just have to take it as it comes. You don't have any power in the situation. So, you know, if all the adults and the experts around you are telling you, you know, hey, something's wrong with you, we got to fix this, we got to treat this, you know, it can become highly internalized. And it wasn't until many, many years later, until, you know, this walk along the Stanford Lake, where I was just kind of had just a moment of peace and clarity where these voices in my head that had told me that something was wrong with my brain, that something was messed up with it, that I had a chemical imbalance or something like that, they weren't really my voice. And I could distinguish in that moment between my voice and the voices in my head, the sort of cultural conditioning that I had received, and that prompted me to get off the drugs and to find a whole bunch of other things, you know, external activity, medical marijuana, more community connection, getting more involved and deeply in my work, other things that brought me senses of satisfaction that didn't involve me trying to fill a hole with a chemical compound. So I actually feel very lucky. You know, I was born in 1983. I'm 33 now. You know, they're now giving antipsychotics to infants. And not to mention, you know, to adolescents and to adults, you know, and diagnosing mental illness and prescribing psychiatric medications in especially young people is something that really upsets me. Really, I think, is one of the worst things about our current pharmaceutical drug oriented culture.
I'm biting my tongue because if I even get started, Brad, on,
right.
I mean, you know, that's what we fight, you know, that's where we're anti-chemical incarceration. We call it, you know, it's that incarcerated to the chemicals to which they serve you based on social constructs, not proven by science, but yet subjectivity. I mean, I'm with you, man. That's one of the biggest fights that I can't stand that, man. So you experienced that though. You actually lived through that.
Yeah, I'm very, very, very grateful for having the resources to get out of it, for being in my socioeconomic class, to be my color of skin, to have the family support that I had. You know, a lot of people don't have that. If your skin color is darker, you don't have the freedom to use psychedelics. Is that the risk is too high? Often, people who aren't able to go to college, you know, who have to work, you know, I mean, there are so many people that I think who could advantage from the careful, really responsible, and limited use of psychedelics. You know, and therapeutic context is one place, is the closest place that we have that, legally speaking, right now, historically.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah,
I've been pushing that, you know, when I got out of doing therapy in those chemical industrial complexes, or the treatment industrial complexes, I call them. You know, part of my break and change, you know, occurred with a psilocybin experience, which I had experienced before in my past, but in a different situation. So, I mean, I've experienced the change, those formations, how they happen, and how, and you, I don't know, it's a, I don't even want to walk down those roads yet. I kind of want to stick to the idea, you know, MAPS, I want to get to that and all the amazing things you guys are doing at MAPS to change the world, to help people, to influence, all the way down to the PTSD work you all do. I mean, these are all things that touch close to my heart and those listeners that are tuning in, I'm sure, you know, but I still, like, I don't know, I love the person in front of me. So the more I learn, the more stories and game changers I get, that, I don't know, the essence of the person I can really grab onto, you know.
Everybody has, I think, a different reason for supporting MAPS, of those who do, and for supporting psychedelic therapy and research. You know, my experience is not everybody's experience.
Beautifully said.
You know, a lot of people who I meet.
Apply that, brother, to people in general in their life. You know, we could so understand other people by going, you know, their perception is not my perception. You know, their experience is mine. And thank you.
Yeah, well, you know, and you know, really what MAPS is serving, you know, immediately right now, through the core thrust of our work, is people with PTSD. And trauma is the one thing that all of our research right now, or the vast majority of it, is focused on. Also other anxiety related conditions. So, you know, there's a lot to learn about what trauma is and how psychedelics can help it. But there's such a long history of therapeutic use of psychedelics. And it's just so exciting right now to be part of kind of the return of psychedelics to the mainstream.
Yeah, it's coming back, man. Take me back to the walk on the lake. So did you sell all your stuff? Did you come back? You know, after the, you know, there's always these stories, right, that we have with our first experience on some psychedelic level. You know, I've given away my things. You know, there's stuff like that. You know, what happened then? What happened to the Stanford, you know, psychology major?
Oh, well, I just got even more excited about psychology at that point. I wasn't, you know, using the drug at a rave. I wasn't going to parties. My inclination, because I went camping when I was a kid and my dad took me hiking and all of that stuff, my inclination, when I was feeling that open, as I was on that substance on that day, was to go outside and to be alone in nature. You know, for a lot of people, their first way into psychedelics is at a party or through some sort of social pressure. That's a very different way in. It's a totally legitimate way in. But the challenges are different. Absolutely. So,
I tend to sound weird when I say things like, well, she'll give you what you ask for. If you go to the rave and that's what you do, that's what you get. If you go for the treatment, that's what you get.
Yeah. If you're lucky, sometimes if you're not even careful with your intention, you don't even know what you're going to get. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't sell all my stuff. Not at all. I got more interested in psychology. I actually added another major. I added communication. Something about psychology, man. Psychology is so fascinating and interesting. And we learn so much about how humans interact. But ultimately, the discipline of psychology, I don't know, academic psychologists, who are working on awesome projects might argue with this, but like my experience of academic psychology was that it was based in a fundamental conception of the human being as this kind of soul autonomous unit. What's happening inside the head, what's happening to this person. Even social psychology, which I loved, was about, how are these individuals interacting? So I added another major. I added communication, which was more about the study of groups and relationships and how meaning flows between different groups. So between the two, I was happy academically and still had a quarter to spare to spend a semester abroad in Chile. So
take me there, man. So you go to Chile after an experience of psychedelic awakening. And I mean, I find the same reason psychology that to be that interested, transpersonal psychology started changing a little bit of that to kind of pulling you out of the self.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, certainly that experience, not necessarily the experience of the drug, but certainly the experience of feeling liberated from this self-concept that I've had. And don't get me wrong, I've got plenty of other self-concepts that are built in that are going to take the rest of my life to uncover and work out. But this particular one was, it was such a relief to get out, to get out of. And that in itself was really inspiring. That gave me a new concept of myself as somebody who could go out and do something like, I'm going to go to Chile and immerse myself in another language. And then after college, I got to travel internationally and lived in China for a little while. And I think it kind of got me out of the, middle school, high school, college, graduate school, white picket fence, wife, dog, kid, dead, kind of line. And so I'm just kind of like, it's made it a little bit more difficult in the sense that like I've had to seek out a career in a field that's not making a lot of money, and I could be putting my effort in Silicon Valley and making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And but instead it's put me kind of like on the fringe. It's an adventurous space and I like to be there.
I love this. I can see it. Who else would you rather have running communications for something as, game-changing as MAPS has been? And they've been around since, 81?
86. I was 3 years old.
Oh, my God. 86. I had that also. I mean, to keep that going for so long, and I mean, to be there for so long, man, there almost has to be a passion. Like you said, you don't, it's not like you find a career in psychedelics too many. It doesn't last long usually. And I'm referring to the street version of psychedelics. That doesn't last long. But finding a way to then educate the public, bringing psychology together, those new waves, traveling around, seeing the new cultures. I love when you said it snapped you out of that, let's just call it what it is, the typical American dream, right? That wake up, if you will. Why do you suppose some people experience a wake up and then kind of just go quickly back to sleep, and some choose to go to Argentina?
Integration, man. Key word is integration. It's not just about the experience. And I think that's one, if there's one thing that psychedelic science is teaching us right now, overall, it's not just the drug that's doing this work. It's all of the preparation that goes into it. It's the set and setting. Just the simple set and setting that Timothy Leary, coined years ago, decades ago. That's very much apt. And then also the value of integration. What happens after the experience? You go to Burning Man, like 70,000 people just did last week, and have an amazing experience, and you feel connected and beautiful and confident, and like everything is clear. And then you get back to your office on Monday and you drill a 60-hour work week, and then expect the changes to hold. Like, of course they're not going to hold. So I think a part of the difference is that some people have the space and the resources to take more time off, to you know, do meditation or yoga, or to travel, or to talk to a therapist about their experiences, or to talk to a community about their experiences and work them out that way. Some people don't have those resources. So that's part of why I think the public education is so important. We're not just promoting psychedelics. We're promoting very responsible, safe uses of psychedelics in very specific contexts.
Yeah, a full way in. I mean, yeah. Some people would even consider, they're so concrete that the idea of safe use of psychedelics would be an oxymoron to just them. I mean, that's how concrete it could be. But until you have that experience, you know, I like to talk about, you know, Dennis Leary sums it up, like you said, but having that safe place, but then doing it properly, preparing for it, walking into it, even if you're doing it recreationally, you know, there's still kind of a ritualistic aspect to when I undertake that session, you know, when I feel that coming on. And I'm circling back to, you talked about focusing on the research of trauma. And I want to bring up Dr. Gabor Maté and his research on addiction to trauma. And is this kind of linking why the focus is on trauma as far as use and what to uncover?
Yeah. Dr. Maté, Gabor Maté, wonderful, wonderful speaker. Just absolutely one of my idols as far as his thinking goes, and how he teaches us about the roots of addiction in trauma. And in fact, the roots of many, in fact, maybe most forms of mental illness that we see today in some kind of trauma, especially early childhood trauma. And of course, early childhood trauma, he talks about this too, also predisposes one to future trauma down the road. You know, and if our anxieties, if social anxiety, if obsessive compulsive disorder, if depression, if PTSD, all of these are anxiety conditions, if addiction, which is also understood as an anxiety condition, if all of these things are rooted in trauma, then looking at treatments that don't just cover up trauma and make it look pretty, but actually get into the root of it, you know, that could be really, really promising. And, you know, right now MAPS is focused very narrowly on using MDMA and psychotherapy to treat post-traumatic stress disorder. But that's just the first of many, many conditions to be explored. That's just because we have to explore one treatment for one particular condition in the FDA drug development process. But we are looking just sort of very widely also at anxiety.
Yeah, he gets attacked a lot for basing it in trauma, you know, that everyone experiences trauma, et cetera. And I happen to be a firm follower and love the way he comes across with the message, what he's saying. I love how he just says, stop the research. It's actually making it worse. And I can tell you, everyone that I counseled at an addiction center, on some level, I promise you, there was a trauma there. Now, I also like to say ghettos in the mind frame. So we can't level out someone's trauma, which is why I hate the idea of severe trauma or mild trauma, because the perception that person experienced, sure, it may not have been a war zone in Afghanistan, but if they were at home being beaten every other week, right? So to judge the trauma is almost the argument people come back with, is that they say everyone experiences trauma on some level. They don't have it this bad, but I'm telling you, everyone I interviewed, everyone that I can see, when you do, it's almost going back to that cancerous traumatic experience or multiple ones that I don't think people even really recognize maybe even have happened sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, everybody is traumatized. The moment of birth is a hugely traumatic event. We don't remember it, but that's very upsetting if you think about it from the perspective of a fetus and its emergence from the womb. I mean, holy cow. Yeah. You know, just that. And then everything else that happens since then, a loud noise, the first time somebody scares you, the first time you cry, the first time, you know, all of these are traumas. PTSD, as soon as we add the D, you know, we're talking about a very narrow classification that's based on the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. You know, it's a classification. Yeah. And that's just, you know, adding up total symptoms. And, you know, some people quote unquote qualify for PTSD and they just have, you know, maybe one tiny little symptom higher than another person and the other person doesn't qualify for PTSD. Unfortunately, for veterans and lots of sexual assault survivors, lots of other people, that little difference there because of that cutoff is going to mean they don't qualify for PTSD treatment from the VA or from their health insurance or whatever like that. So yeah, you're absolutely right. Like it's totally arbitrary. We just have to like, for the research, we have to be able to evaluate boom, 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 boom.
I think it's a great place to start, man. I mean, you talked about symptomatic treatment, excuse me, man, but I call basically anxiety, depression. I call these symptoms. I mean, these aren't things that we,
yeah.
You know, I don't like saying things like I am depressed or things like this, right? I mean, these things yeah. become affected by, and we're such a reactive, we are even in treatment therapy, psychotherapy, I don't care, it's even medicine, it's such a reactive system. We respond with symptoms, you know. I always love the example medically, if you have the flu and you go to the doctor and they treat your sore throat, you still have the flu. Well, fuck yeah, you know. So we're based to set up to treat symptoms, and like you said on the diagnostic guessing subjectivity manual, we try to group people into things, right? It's so opposite the medical diagnosis, right? It's not a factual, you have a broken arm, look at the broken arm. You know, it's, well, you kind of match this stuff subjectively. So, and the fact that it matches to where it doesn't receive care, this is where it starts to touch on my buttons. You know, sure, you want to treat symptoms with pills and keep shoving more chemicals down people to replace it and band-aid it and band-aid it. But the fact that people, you know, even with the VA and just anybody, won't have access to service, again, based on a perception created by some insurance cutoff.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, when so when treatments are approved for PTSD, they're approved for anybody diagnosed with PTSD. So they don't have to have severe PTSD or moderate PTSD. They'll, you know, they're available for everybody with PTSD. And, you know, what you're saying, you know, it really, you know, it reminds me that, you know, another, you know, major difference from, you know, between psychedelic therapy, what's being developed through MAPS and other organizations, and the current pharmaceutical model, is that the current pharmaceutical model really relies on taking a drug every day for the rest of your life. Very, very often, it's all about fitting a key into a hole, and you know, you have a deficiency of some sort in your brain when it comes to mental illness. And so we have to fill it with this other chemical so that it comes back to normal. And that model of just a simple equilibrium like that is just increasingly we're finding it's just not how the brain works.
Dr. Carl Hart said it yesterday. He basically said that to look at the chemicals or think that we can adjust them, measure them, or these are the causes, or you say you can't diagnose mood disorders, et cetera, with these ideas.
Yeah, that's right. So the pharmaceutical companies end up having to recoup all of these losses that they take on failed drug development pipelines and make all of those losses back through the sales of approved drugs and devices. So for-profit pharmaceutical companies have an incentive to get drugs out there that people are going to pay a lot for, or insurance companies are going to pay a lot more, usually people. Just keep people on them for the rest of their lives consistently. So the two currently approved drugs for PTSD are Prozac and Zoloft. They work for, they work to reduce symptoms for a lot of people, but they have to keep taking them. And people often co-medicate with alcohol and other drugs.
Well, and even with when you're dealing with a lot of those drugs, the effectiveness over time, you deal with intolerance as well over it. I mean, it's just what chemical incarceration. It's a life sentence. It's just what you do now. That's what the doctor would tell you. No, you don't take this for like 6 weeks and fill the prescription and you're done. You just do this now. And
yeah,
you may wake up one day and want to hang yourself. But just don't pay attention to that and call
it. It's just a side effect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you were bridging a huge difference. And I'm going to tell an alleged story here very quickly. Perhaps someone that I knew was dealing with veterans, and someone that was not being treated didn't meet a line, even though he had 20 years of nightmares and alcoholic. I mean, it was terrible. in the same dream over and over and over for 20 years, every night, if you can imagine that. And he was a sniper, actually, in the military. And anyway, 3 weeks preparation and a psilocybin treatment, and never had the dream again, never drank again. Wife came back, and he rebuilt his construction company.
That's just a miracle story. That's amazing.
I can't unfucking see that, Brad. You know what I mean? Like, I can't be like, well, that didn't fucking happen. You know what I mean? I can't, you know, that's what
So how do we take these experiences that people have, and they do have them, and make them accessible and make them available to everybody? So it's not just like, oh, fortunately I scored some shrooms and got to do this thing. And they're like, yeah, I tracked down an underground therapist or what have you. You know, that everybody can legitimately access them, and we can talk about them in public, and we can talk about them in the fields of policy and in the fields of public health and in academic institutions. And I mean,
you mean really educate our youth about the true effects, like Dr. Carl Hart was saying, on drugs, and how you won't just be on the crack pipe pole the first time you smell it?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, yeah, that's what you deal with. I reference all the way back to the first question, man. You're dealing with that sort of cognitive dissonance on a mainstream front line. And yeah. Like I said, and you're the communication guy in the trenches, dude. Like, that's gotta be hard, man.
Yeah. You know, it feels like that sometimes. And, you know, especially when, you know, we want to, you know, put out an announcement in a newspaper that doesn't want to take our ad, or we submit a grant application to a major research foundation and they say, no, we're not ready to look at that. Or a government agency says, you know, no, we're not just going to look at your protocol anymore. That no doesn't happen in the U.S. anymore, fortunately, after all these decades of work. Finally, we have great relationships. But for example, we tried to start a study of MDMA assisted psychotherapy for PTSD in Jordan about 6 years ago. And the Jordanian FDA, which is their equivalent over there, just wouldn't look at it. No. They're just like, no, we're dealing with other things right now. We don't have the capacity to deal with psychedelic research right now. So there's that. We get, we're still getting closed doors within the military and the VA, still unwilling to support a study. You know, we're hoping that the results from a study that we're now completing, looking at veterans, firefighters, and police officers with PTSD, will help open up those conversations some more. But we still encounter that resistance. And, you know, it's not individuals. You know, it's even when we speak with, you know, high ranking military officials, which we have, our executive director, Rick Doblin, my boss, he's actually been to the Pentagon, and he's spoken with senior psychiatrists with the VA and the Departments of Defense. And, you know, individually, one on one, people are supportive. Like, yeah, you know, we need better care for our veterans. We need better care for our active duty personnel. You know, we'd love to see, you know, something happen sometime. It's just, we can't get publicly on board with it right now. I'm not sure what my commanding officer will think. And then you go and talk to the commanding officer and they're like, oh yeah, you know, personally, I really support this, but I'm not sure what my commanding officer is going to think. And it just goes like that all the way up the chain until it comes down to the president's public image. And, it's been like that for decades. So that said, it's all about that connection with the individuals. You know, even if the institutions aren't publicly ready to support it, to put out a press release about it, or to fund the research, then at least having those individual conversations is totally possible. You know, it goes all the way up the chain. It's all about the public image. It's really not about the individual conversations that we have. You know, individually, people are often supportive, especially if you can talk about psychedelic therapy in terms of healing trauma, healing PTSD, getting honest education out, reducing the risks associated with recreational use. You know, almost anybody can understand that these days, especially with medical marijuana gaining so much momentum, as people can kind of, okay, maybe there are some ways to do it, but it has to be in a clinical context. And you say, yes, that's exactly what we're talking about. So that's a great way to start the conversation with individuals one-on-one. But again, the institutions, but institutions follow the public, you know, as soon as there's enough people
I wonder how much the government and these local municipals or and states are just going, well, look, we're already losing 1/3 of our income by legalizing marijuana right now because we can't kick indoors anymore and lock people up in prisons anymore, or private ones. So hold on there, MAPS. You guys got to wait. We can still arrest hippies and shit for psychedelics, right? And, you know, so one at a time here, you know, they got to find a way to replace budgets, man.
Oh yeah. And if they legalize it, they sure will.
You know, it's, I'm just saying, man, I hate to say that it's even like that, right. Or be a push, but I mean, it does. It just seems if something else, let's say, I don't know, let's put out half of these fucking methamphetamine drugs they put out that are fat burners and weight loss. I mean, they do a study with 10 people and 7 people lose a quarter pound. They can say 70%, you know, it works. But we can kick out methamphetamine fat fucking pills for everybody and everyone goes nuts that you either get smarter. If you're getting smarter, you're getting thinner. Hell, the FDA will stamp that son of a bitch in 3 hours and put it on the floor, you know. And now I this leads to a question. Sorry, my rants typically do. I hear it a lot and want to kind of venture down this with you. Are they addictive? Are psilocybin addictive? Or can psychedelics become highly addictive?
Okay, so the first thing, you know, always have to address when we ask, is something addictive, is what is addictive?
Yeah,
you know?
Sorry, shitty fucking question.
Well, it's an education opportunity.
Yeah, I you know, and Jess, you're right. You know what I'm sorry. You educate us, man.
Right.
DSM addiction.
So that means it's having a negative impact on somebody's quality of life and they're trying to quit and they can't, you know, effectively that's what the, you know, addiction is. Now, you know, there's also the more general sort of cultural understanding of addiction, which is just that they're, you know, somebody's using a drug to excess. You know, that's totally different than the diagnosis of addiction. So, you know, do people abuse psychedelics? Yes. Yes, there are people that abuse psychedelics. There's people who use them too much. They use them to excess. I don't know if there's many people who have made significant efforts to stop and it negatively affects their quality of life. It may negatively affect their quality of your life and then they don't try to stop, which is still an addiction.
Diet Coke. Yeah.
I mean, you should probably still stop.
I'm kind of backpedaling now. What I was trying to do is really kind of lead into the talk that, you know, of course, everything can be addiction, you know, or be addictive. And yeah, you know, if it affects our biopsychosocial, et cetera, we can look at it as being
yeah.
that.
Yeah, I'd say it can be abused, but no, compared to all of the, you know, drugs that are classically addictive, no, they're not addictive. There's no evidence that psilocybin is addictive. There's no evidence that LSD is addictive from a scientific perspective. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence that MDMA is addictive. There's no evidence that ayahuasca or DMT are addictive or peyote is addictive. In fact, a lot of these compounds, used in a supportive therapeutic context may even have some anti-addictive tendencies. Often people, certainly who come in for our clinical research using psychedelics and therapy, LSD or MDMA, they'll come out saying, you know, not only do I want to get off of alcohol, I want to get off of smoking cigarettes. I want to get off of all the prescription pharmaceuticals I was on. I don't even want to take LSD or MDMA again. And people are done. You know, it's not this model of filling a chemical hole for people. It's a model of showing them a way just not to need that.
Yeah, I love the way you said it. Not filling a hole, like, you know, here's the depressant, here's the chemical incarceration. What you guys aren't doing is say, here's mushrooms for life, right? Here's a few treatments based on what we have that are based on the research we have on the best way to facilitate safety and setting. And rather than this extended life, you have to come back now for 3 years of therapy to work out your trauma issues.
Yeah, no, maybe 3 years later, come back for another session.
Yeah. Yeah. So walk us through what it's really like, you know, how the treatments are going over there. Like, you know, take me through it. Like, compare it maybe to what typical therapy would be. You know, what are the approaches going on? Take me in the lab, man.
Yeah. That's the fun stuff. So again, we're doing clinical trials right now. So we're right in the middle of two phases of research. Next year, we're going to start the largest phase of research where we're going to be treating 200 to 400 additional participants. We've already treated over 100 participants in the first phase of research. And this is all just MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for the treatment of PTSD. We have other research that we're doing looking at MDMA combined with therapy for other conditions. We can talk about that later, but right now, our main focus is on PTSD. So, for these studies, it's definitely, you know, like we were talking about, not a take two and call me in the morning kind of, or go to the pharmacy and pick it up yourself or anything like that. No. So once people are accepted into the study, you know, we can look at this from the perspective of post-approval. So once it's approved, once MDMA is approved, then doctors will be able to prescribe it. And it will only be able to be used in an inpatient setting together with psychotherapy. So that just means that people come in for their treatment with MDMA and they stay the night and they don't go home until the next day, and then somebody comes and picks them up. It would be just like going into a hospital for a quick inpatient surgery and then going out the next day. No surgery or blood, though. So the way that the whole process works is it's several sessions. So we're looking at two sessions or three sessions of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. That's MDMA administered in the morning when people come in for their experimental sessions. They come into the clinic. They say hello to the psychotherapist, who they've already been meeting with for several weeks. So there are several preparatory sessions where they just come in and have standard psychotherapy. They're just 2 or 3 hour long psychotherapy sessions. People talk about their trauma. They talk about their life. They talk about issues that might come up during the experimental MDMA session. And then finally, when they come in the morning, they say hello to the psychotherapists. We always use a husband and wife, or we have used a husband and wife co-therapist team. Now we're just using any two male-female co-therapists for the MDMA research. And the reason there being is because often when people are talking about trauma, sexual trauma can come up. And especially when magnified by the effects of MDMA in the therapeutic setting, it can become more difficult for the subject to talk to one or the other of the therapist. So if they had a difficult experience with a man, they might want to talk to the woman, and so on and so forth. And also having two enables one to leave the room for a snack or a restroom break or something, because the active MDMA sessions are 8 hours long. So the whole duration of effects of MDMA, you know, generally 3 to 6 hours. So the sessions are 8 hours long, just to kind of have that whole container there. And the subject takes the MDMA in the morning, and they talk for an hour, or they don't talk. Often the subject is just very quiet. There's no demand or requirement that people talk. One thing that makes the actual therapy process very different from standard psychoanalysis is that it's what we call non-directive. So we usually think of the sort of Freudian situation where we have the patient lying on the couch and the therapist sitting back here with a notepad, and the therapist is here analyzing and interpreting the patient's experiences or dreams or what have you. There is no interpretation happening here in these sessions. It's not, oh, this is what your experience means, or it's not, oh, don't you want to think about it in that way? Never any of that. Rather, yeah. So rather, it's all letting the participant lead the entire session.
So you're starting with like the client centered, kind of the beginning of psychology, not all the way into the like CBT type stuff.
Yeah, there are a lot of CBT techniques used, the cognitive behavioral. There's also other techniques, EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprocessing. That's another form that's kind of woven in and integrated. We actually have an entire treatment manual where we have a manualized, standardized treatment manual, which is available on the MAPS website. You can check it out for free, and it explains everything about the therapeutic process, from the set and the setting to the language and the body position of the therapists. Also, sometimes there's some light therapeutic touch, which will happen. Some like simple body work can often happen if the participant asks for it. It won't be offered. It won't be.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with a hug unless you're a licensed counselor.
Exactly. It's only in our sort of mainstream conventional psychiatric psychopharmaceutical system that doesn't happen, where you come in and it's a 15-minute visit and you get your script and you go home and you come back 3 months later. It's the absolute opposite of that. So after this session, the participant stays the night. And the reason I'm calling them participants is just because they're participants in the trial. Once this is an approved treatment, they'll be patients. Yeah, so we just don't want to jump the gun. We can celebrate that change when it happens.
No, it's important. I mean, what you're saying it is what it is. Yeah, you got to be careful there.
Yeah. And so after that, they go home. There's some follow-up phone calls. Therapists check in with the participant every day for a few days, and then have another face-to-face follow-up session with them. And then that's followed again by another session with MDMA-assisted psychotherapy a couple weeks later. And then in some of our trials, we've done another third session as well. But the bulk of our data is coming from that second point, where we are seeing really significant drops in PTSD symptoms. And then there's one more set of follow-up sessions, and the whole thing lasts 6 to 8 weeks. It's a 6 to 8 week course of psychotherapy with two or three active MDMA sessions in there.
Yeah. So is there anything opposite, like anything you focus on in the rooms or in the settings? You said the therapist's, you know, mannerisms, how they're sitting. What's the room like? Is it bland? Is it decorated? Is there music? Is there, you know, what's different from conventional?
It's not a hospital setting. So it's explicitly not a hospital setting, which is to say it's more like a living room. It's more like a very comfortable therapist's office, like you might see in a really nice therapist's office. There's, you know, books, and there's little sculptures, you know, nice art, you know, non-suggestive, you know, so there's not going to be like a big red picture of a dragon above the couch, You know, with psychedelics, often unconscious material becomes a lot more available, and it tends to come out more. And then also that unconscious level becomes more exposed at the same time. So there's no sort of suggestive material around the office that could push the experience. So it's very carefully arranged, but it's pleasant. It's room-like. It's a place that's designed to hang out in for 8 to 10 hours at a time.
Well, I love all the attention to detail, because there's those small things when you're working on such a sensitive subject as trauma, that can be very trigger-like, that can be changing, you know. So is there any music in the background?
You asked.
Yeah, that's all.
Yeah, music. Yeah, there is. If the participant wants music, okay, then music is provided. It's also non-directive, you know. It's not going to be like raging electronic music. It's going to be, you know, classical music or just kind of lighter stuff. It can be like more intense or less intense, but generally no words.
Yeah. Words would be, it'd be suggestive as the dragon above the couch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I like it. So a 6 to 8 week session. And then obviously, I don't know if you can talk about any kind of results you're seeing or kind of separate.
Sure.
Or can you go there?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. We've had a couple of published studies already, which is why I can talk about them. And then also so we've just completed total of 6 phase 2 trials with over 100 total participants in those trials, all people with PTSD. And they were all people who had chronic and treatment resistant PTSD. So what that means is that they'd had PTSD for a long period of time, and they'd also sought other treatments, and the other treatments did not work for them. So these are really, you know, you might say some of the most difficult cases of PTSD, people who are, you know, all over the map. Our first completed study, which was in Charleston, South Carolina, and that was primarily female survivors of sexual assault and abuse. There were a couple others in there, but mostly women. And they had, the 19 subjects in that trial had PTSD for an average length of 19 years.
Wow.
As an average. So some much longer and some a little shorter. Yeah.
About 19 years of not sleeping. That's what automatically where I go to, because the PTSD nightmares are ridiculous.
For many of them. Yeah, absolutely. And afterwards, after 2 sessions of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy, 83% of them didn't have PTSD anymore after those 2 sessions. So many of them still had some PTSD symptoms.
The
PTSD scale goes from like 0 to 100. And, you know, many of them were upwards of 80 or 90 in severity. And we had drops down to 7 or lower. And 7, by the way, if you get a 7 on the PTSD scale, you do not have PTSD. You may be.
Yeah. Little.
Most people probably rate a 7 on the PTSD scale.
Let's put it about a hypervigilance level. Yeah, but yeah. My God, 80-something percent.
Yeah, yeah. And just to be scientifically sound, you know, the placebo comparison was 25%. So 25% of those who did not receive MDMA, they just went through all the therapy sets, so the 6 to 8 weeks, and instead of getting MDMA on those two occasions, they only got a placebo.
Yeah.
And 25% of them.
Yeah, to help people understand that is to where a lot of people argue that the placebo effect plays into the miraculous recovery and seems to change. But then when you test it without the placebo and it's only at 25, this is a huge argument for anyone that would state that placebo effect having that lasting change.
Yeah, the placebo effect with these was better than the final results for the currently approved medications for PTSD.
Man, oh my! See, this is the shit, man. This is
and these are real people, you know. Who these are not just numbers; these are real people. And
how do you find them? What's the background on the participants here? What are some of the qualifications, or you know, what's the
so chronic and treatment resistant PTSD? You know, we have a whole list of exclusion and inclusion criteria. We make sure they don't have a history of cardiac problems or neurological conditions or drug abuse that might make the use of MDMA more risky for them. So that's a huge way that we cut down on the risks of pure MDMA in clinical trials is by carefully screening people. Anybody who's used MDMA on their own more than a handful of times is excluded generally because you're just not going to get the
effect of it, right? Because most people that are coming to the therapist office are not going to be ex-DJs that spun at rave nightclubs for a couple of years.
Most, but we want them to be able to get it too.
But I mean, you've got to be that way. I mean, you're asking one of the a government that still schedules marijuana on one to give you an open pass to test this. So I mean, I get that you gotta come at this with every I dotted, T crossed. You gotta take the flow too.
Yeah. So that was just our first completed trial. We had another successful trial in Switzerland. And then overall, we're looking at phase two. So all of our phase two studies combined, all six of them combined, we're looking at about 60%. So about 60% of those who received two sessions of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy didn't have PTSD anymore after treatment. So that 60% is lower than the 83%, but that's in 100 participants instead of just 19. So the statistical power is much stronger on that.
Oh, yeah. And listen, nothing can say cured PTSD at 1%. Nothing. So the fact that you can say 60 no longer had it, that AKA cured PTSD, there's not a drug out there that can say that.
Yeah. Yeah. And the participants will say it. They use the word cured. Some will. The headlines will say it. But this is just like my job because we're talking about rebranding and destigmatizing psychedelics and psychedelic science, you know, is that, we won't say cure. Because for some of these people, their PTSD symptoms came back a little bit later.
I think cure is strong because you do walk into the perception creation that someone.
Yeah, we call it durable remission, which is as close as you can call a cure in medical terminology.
Yeah. Well, I can
because people can be re-traumatized or what have you. Yeah.
Yeah, I love the term. You gotta play it safe. Me on the cognitive rampage gets to say what I want. So no, but you're right though. It's important because saying things like that then can backbatter the data that comes out. To where when people come back, then you start to look like it's not that. So that, I think that's a great, I don't want to say political, but it's smart. You know what I mean? To take that approach.
Yeah. It's just honest. All the propaganda we've gotten has been so dishonest. It's just honest. I don't know if I could work in a marketing profession for something that I didn't believe in. I just think I'd probably just do something completely different.
Yeah, I think I could probably sell. Everybody used to tell me, Adam, you could sell anything. I'm like, no, I can't. I can't sell shit if I don't believe in it.
Yeah, that's right.
You can't. You know, I can't unsee the things that I have. And so what's new on the horizon coming up with MAPS, man? What's exciting? What should the people know about? What hasn't been tweeted or shared yet?
I'm glad you asked, Adam, because you didn't even know this, but we just launched our the website for our upcoming major international conference. which is called Psychedelic Science 2017. It will be taking place in Oakland in the East San Francisco Bay Area in April, from April 19th to 24th, 2017. It's a 6-day, it's going to be just a epic international gathering of scientists and researchers, policymakers, students, doctors, artists. We have a conference and workshops and a cruise and a psychedelic comedy banquet where we're going to have an array of stand-ups and raise funds for psychedelic research. Website psychedelicscience.org. Advanced tickets are on sale. And that's going to be my major focus as a conference director for that conference for the next eight months or so. We're hoping to have about 1,500 to 2,000 people filling up Oakland, California. And
I think I'm
going to make a splash.
I think I'm going to have to come in. You should have a guy out there. He's talking about running for sheriff out there, Michael Wood Jr. Have you heard of Michael Wood Jr. before? He's the cop that spoke out in Baltimore, et cetera. Been on Joe Rogan a few times. Been all over, really.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, he rings a bell. Well, if he's running for sheriff, he should come to the conference.
Yeah, he's thinking about it. He was just on this podcast not long ago, but he's been on Young Turk, CNN, all that stuff. But he's pro everything. It's, you know, I love his views on what to do with the actual cop situation. But anyway, he's got him out there, man. And hey, is anyone broadcasting from there live?
Not yet.
There's a great show called The Cognitive Rampage where a guy can ramble and rampage on just about any mental health topic known to man.
I mean, we would love to have you there. We're going to have epic tons of content. They're going to have 100 presenters, you know, 6 days. You know, Ethan Nadelman of the Drug Policy Alliance, he'll be a speaker there. So we get to have some talks on policy and psychedelics as well. Summer grad.
Page like 30 minutes with everybody that comes off the stage. Just give me 30 minutes. I'll rampage with everybody. Passers by, hang out. We'll set up. They'll come sit down. We'll just chat with them about the conference. We'll stream live for like 6 straight days.
Oh, that'll be fantastic, man.
All right. I'll buy the tickets, man. I'll see you there. Yeah. I'll see you. Cover the dates and everything again, the website for everybody.
Yeah, let's follow up about it. That's great. Yeah, we're already selling tickets. We have not even announced it formally yet. And tickets are already coming in. We're still adding speakers and more information about the banquet and the cruise and everything else. So,
You did. All right. The Rampage got the first MAPS announcement of the psychedelic gathering, dude. I love it.
First official one.
Dude, I love it. I'm feeling all obliged today, man. I mean, I know you're only scheduled for an hour, so I'm tiptoeing across that hour, man. But, I mean, we could chat further along. What's beyond the PTSD treatment? What's in the next 5-10 years of MAPS?
Well, first of all, the PTSD next 5 to 10 years, we're currently expecting that once the phase 3 trials are complete, again, they're starting next year, that the FDA could approve MDMA for use in psychotherapy for PTSD as early as 2021.
Now, it used to be approved.
It was.
Or was it just used?
It was formerly just used. So it was just circulated. It was used therapeutically, but it had never gone through clinical trials. It had never really come to the attention of the public at large. When it did, it was scheduled because it had come to the attention of the public via ecstasy and its use in club settings. But then it was criminalized. So this would be the first time MDMA will have been approved for any specific use. In fact, unless marijuana or psilocybin come first, but it's looking like MDMA might be, you know, that would be the first Schedule I drug approved for a specific medical use.
Wow. Even before marijuana, I hate to even say that it shouldn't be, but you look at a plant that's never killed anyone or addicted anyone and MDMA.
Yeah.
I love the victory, man. Wow. Pulling them off one at a time to do that, man. That's
it takes patience. That's the big challenge.
Well, I guess, man, and or a push from the public. You know, I would urge anybody listening to this, you know, to tell your story about it. Write your senators, Republicans, push it the same way this consciousness did marijuana. You know, if we can do that, everyone listening, please. I mean, hell, write everyone, talk about it, share your experience. I do. I mean, please. I mean, these are things that change people's lives, and we don't let them touch it, man.
They sure are. And, you know, we don't want to be proselytizers. We're not like flag waving here. We're not, you know, anything like that. But we're just stating the research like it is. And, that might just help speak for itself.
I'll wave that flag. You guys keep playing the walk that tight beam you have to, dealing with the government, walk those things, do that, man. I get it, man. You guys do it. Guys like me, there's girls out there doing shows like me and all in between. Everybody else, we'll wave the flags for you, man, on the front side saying, look, man, I know this changes lives. Come on, public, wake the fuck up, man, and let's help and change some lives, man. Like,
man, it takes a village for sure. And we could not do it without that public support.
Yeah, man. I think I threw us off track. So over the next 5 to 10, we're finishing up the PTSD.
Oh, yeah, 5 to 10. So 2021, we got prescription approval for MDMA. And then it can be used legally in conjunction with psychotherapy for the treatment of PTSD. We are also just starting this new clinical trial of marijuana to treat symptoms of PTSD in veterans. So not getting at the root. This is just using smoked whole plant marijuana. So starting the development of whole plant marijuana in the FDA drug development process, that assuming this next trial is successful, it could be 10 to 15 years in the making to actually get that all the way approved through that. That's just how long it takes to conduct a phase 3 clinical trial. Yeah. So that could be a lot longer. So we need to keep pushing at the state level. We got to keep pushing at the policy level. We got to keep pushing for rescheduling and all of that stuff in the meantime. And so far, pushing for this research has helped. Just calling for the research, showing how obstructed it has been for the last 20 some odd years, has highlighted the problem, I think, in a really effective way. So even if it takes another 15 years for it to happen, you know, that's a, you know, the researchers trying to get this research started are a bulldozer that are helping clear the way for a lot more research down the road.
What do we do, man? What are the fans of MAPS and the Rampage, and what do we do out here to assist this? Since you're in the trenches every day, you know, fighting it, what do we do on our end, really?
Yeah, well, certainly you're a fine model of this, Adam. Not shying away from conversation, you know, not avoiding the topic because it's difficult. If you know, you or somebody you know has had a beneficial experience with psychedelics, or for that matter, a difficult experience with psychedelics, please, you know, talk about them, even with just a close friend, but get it out there and get it talking. I cannot tell you how many times I have spoken with people who had powerful experiences decades ago, and because of the stigma, because of their social surroundings or their family or their concepts of that, hadn't talked about it. And then just seeing that this research is happening and seeing that it's a conversation topic that people are willing to have, and that it's public, and there's major conferences and there's websites and there's like social media conversations happening about it all the time, that just draws people out and want to share their experiences. So in your own communities, you know, I'd say anybody, you know, who has a connection with any group of people who wants to have a conversation about it, MAPS has a wonderful opportunity called the Global Psychedelic Dinners, psychedelicdinners.org, which is just all about helping you bring your community together, talking openly about psychedelic experiences, benefits, and the risks, and helping support greater cultural understanding for psychedelic science and medicine that way. And then, of course, you know, sharing on social media. You know, I love social media. It's just like, you know, complain as you will about any particular platform and how it might restrict or like encourage, you know, advertising, whatever. But in general, news spreads faster today than it ever has across the planet. And small things can become big issues very, very, very quickly. And so we can change public perception very, very quickly. And that's the key thing in the way of more funding and more research and more access to psychedelics and cannabis over the next 10 to 20 years. It's just that public perception. We've seen what's happened with medical marijuana. Just we've seen that snowball, and we've seen once legalization starts, it just goes and goes and goes. You know, I'm not like, you know, I'm kind of knocking on wood a little bit, but like, you know, really like, we're heading down the path towards federally legal marijuana, you know, certainly statewide across all the states. And we've seen how that snowball has accelerated, you know, in the last 5-6 years. So we can see how quickly public opinion, just awareness of an issue can transform funding, can transform legal policies, can transform education, and everything surrounding a formerly illicit drug. So here we have that opportunity again with psychedelics. And, you know, it's all through sharing, and it's all through having conversations. That's all through engaging and signing up for the MAPS newsletter and just taking advantage of every opportunity you can to talk about it. I certainly do.
That's called a rampage you just walked into, brother. That was good, man. You walk right on the man. You went off there. I found Brad's button. It's ask him what we need to do to help your message.
Man, there is so much there. I feel like an octopus sometimes. So many people want to help. And our policy, our policy is MAPS, is to find a way to say yes to everybody who wants to help or contribute in some way, and that we will talk with you and we will work with you and we will find a way that we can do something together. Even if it's not what either of us initially envisioned, we just want to say yes because we need support, we need community, and we want to learn. We're not going this alone. But now we have a lot of attention from regulators and the media and policymakers, and it's a great opportunity.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, this, the Cognitive Rampage microphone, the Tribe of Change, anytime you guys need anything, man, I'll grab one of those tentacles, man, and just button, tell me what to do. And I definitely don't have a problem saying it. So
it's been a privilege speaking with you, Adam. And thanks so much for doing a huge part to get the word out. Lots of people listen and, we share it out widely, and it just helps so much. So thanks for connecting with us.
No, man. Thanks for connecting with me, man. I appreciate you sharing your early stories, man. Those ones that really influenced you and touched you to heart, man. Thanks for opening up for me and bringing some education too to the show, man. Thank you. That's why I do it.
Hey, man. It's all connected.
We all, brother, man. Again, dude, thank you very much. Tell everybody at MAPS, man. Their Tribe of Change Warriors are behind them. Cognitive Rampage behind it. Anything anybody needs. I don't care what level of MAPS you're on, man. We're here and we're at war with you, man.
Yeah, for sure, man. Thanks so much.
All right, Brad, I appreciate it, man.
All right, we'll see you at Psychedelic Science.
Oh, I will see you. I promise you.
Yeah.
I promise you, brother. Okay, man, take care.
All right, Adam, take it easy.